ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 24th of October. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. In the United States, the FBI has unveiled a major gambling and sports rigging investigation that involves the National Basketball Association and organised crime. More than 30 people have been charged in two separate but related cases, including a current player, a former head coach, and an NBA Hall of Famer. North America correspondent Cayman Gock joined me earlier. Cayman, take us through the case and how Miami Heat player Terry Rozier is implicated.
Yeah, this could be considered your more typical match-fixing scandal, which has involved current player Terry Rozier and also a former NBA player, Damon Jones. Both of those two are accused of being involved in this criminal betting scheme, allegedly using insider information and performance manipulation to make money off NBA games. Prosecutors say that information from several NBA players, including those two, was distributed through a network of bettors in order to make money off a range of NBA games. And Mr. Rozier has been accused of telling people close to him that he planned to make an early exit from a game in 2023 in order for those people to win big off bets tied to his performance. Now, the NBA has been dogged by gambling scandals for more than a year and a half already. And we've seen Toronto Raptors forward Jonte Porter banned for life for conspiring with gamblers to fix his performances in NBA games. And this is just the latest scandal for the league.
And Cayman, NBA Hall of Famer Chauncey Billups is also allegedly involved in another separate investigation. What do authorities allege there?
Yeah, this investigation was labelled Operation Royal Flush, and it's a separate but related case where more than two dozen people have been charged. This is the head coach of the Portland Trailblazers, and he's also an NBA Hall of Famer. Now, Mr. Jones has also been accused of being involved in this scheme. It's alleged that they were involved in this rigged poker game system, and the scheme was organised by four of the five major New York mafia families, prosecutors allege. And the authorities highlighted how rare and extraordinary it is for these four mafia families to allegedly been working together on this. Basically, the scheme would lure in victims by offering them the chance to play with these famous sporting stars. And it's alleged that both Billups and Jones knew the poker games were fixed. And prosecutors say that technology was used, like X-ray tables, hidden cameras, and tampered shuffling machines to cheat these victims out of millions of dollars. The FBI director, Kash Patel, says that this was a wide-sweeping criminal enterprise.
And the fraud is mind-boggling. It's not hundreds of dollars. It's not thousands of dollars. It's not tens of thousands of dollars. It's not even millions of dollars. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars in fraud and theft and robbery across a multi-year investigation.
FBI Director Kash Patel, and before him, Cayman Gock in Washington. US President Donald Trump touches down in Malaysia this weekend to attend the ASEAN summit. It's his first visit to the region since wreaking havoc on Southeast Asian economies by introducing his disruptive trade tariff system. Indonesia correspondent Tim Swanston filed this report from West Java.
David Leonardi's textile factory is constantly humming with the activity of dyeing machines and looms. It's located south of Bandung in West Java, the beating heart of Indonesia's textile industry. Mr. Leonardi says there's never been a more challenging moment for the business than now, with manufacturers squeezed by US tariffs and Chinese imports. He's worried if the tariffs continue, he'll be forced to lay off workers.
It's going to be a big, major problem with Indonesia. Why? Because this is one sector of the industry which can absorb people with primary graduates, secondary, high school graduates, you know.
US President Donald Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariffs have been in effect for almost 3 months now in the region, with most Southeast Asian nations slugged with a 19 or 20% tariff on their exports to the United States market. A report by the United Nations Development Programme says the region will be hit hard, predicting about a 10% decline in exports from Southeast Asia to the US as a result of tariff-induced price hikes. Deputy Minister for Indonesia's Coordinating Ministry for Economic Affairs, Eddie Pamburi, says Indonesia, much like other Southeast Asian nations, is trying to negotiate carve-outs for certain products in a bid to reduce the damage to the economy.
We understand that the US now is trying to implement the US National Emergency Act because they face the trade deficit. But again, trade is not zero-sum game. I win, you lose. No. Because the principle of trade is win-win solution.
The tariffs have had another consequence in Southeast Asia, dramatically increasing exports from China to the region. During Trump's first term, Chinese exporters increasingly moved their goods through Southeast Asia in a bid to avoid tariffs, a practice known as transshipment. Those transshipments are now subject to even higher tariffs. So to avoid the headache and taxes of the US market, Chinese exporters have changed tack and are selling into Southeast Asia, threatening local manufacturers like Mr. Leonardi.
We can also survive. These imported goods, the price is, for example, three times, four times cheaper compared to the local ones. Which one do you think you will buy?
The upending of global trade will likely be a key point of discussion at this weekend's Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, summit in Malaysia. US President Donald Trump will attend to oversee a ceasefire and peace ceremony between Thailand and Cambodia. ASEAN economies will be eager to use the FaceTime with the president to talk trade and tariffs or improve their bilateral relations to bolster their negotiations.
Tim Swanston there in West Java. The King of England, who's also the head of the Church of England, has joined the Catholic Pope in prayer for the first time in almost 500 years. The show of interfaith solidarity comes as the scandal engulfing the royal family shows no signs of going away. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer is in London.
The King arrives at the Vatican. He greets Pope Leo XIV before entering the Sistine Chapel to pray.
O God, make speed to save us.
Lord, make haste to help us.
Charles is the head of the Church of England, and a British monarch hasn't prayed with a pontiff since Henry VIII broke away from the Vatican in 1534 due to his wish to remarry. The King has met with three popes, but this is the first time he's joined the head of the Catholic Church in prayer. Later, a visit to a cathedral outside the walls of the Vatican, where him and his wife Camilla are greeted with rapturous applause. But this grand show of interfaith diplomacy is doing little to mitigate the PR crisis engulfing the royal family. Questions surrounding Prince Andrew's abuse allegations, his links to the late pedophile and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, and the extent to which he's been protected by the royal family are intensifying.
I can imagine that the palace is disappointed, perhaps even dismayed, that the King's visit to the Vatican has been overshadowed.
That's the voice of Dr. Craig Prescott, an author and constitutional law and monarchy expert at the Royal Holloway University in London.
Essentially, the future of the monarchy is in showing that it has some public utility. I don't think there's much room in the modern monarchy for a figure like Prince Andrew these days.
MPs in the British Parliament are mobilising, trying to figure out different mechanisms they can use to punish the prince and strip him of titles and royal trappings. But the government is yet to call for a debate on the issue.
When it comes to matters that are just about the royal family, the government of the day, whether it's Labour or Conservative, take a lead from Buckingham Palace. And so that's how it tends to play out. But this is playing out a little bit differently, because Parliament is perhaps taking a different stance from the palace, and the government has to work with Parliament and work with the palace. And so it's a little bit piggy in the middle.
The prince is living rent-free at the Royal Lodge, and calls for him to leave the luxurious royal residence are growing louder. But evicting Andrew would be highly complex. It's not just a matter of the king kicking his brother out.
Prince Andrew has a lease effectively with the Crown Estate, not the king. And in a sense, as long as he complies with the terms of the lease, he can in principle stay there.
The king will now return to the United Kingdom, and the saga surrounding his brother that doesn't seem to be going away. This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
As Victoria grapples with what police describe as a crime crisis, a new program operating in Melbourne's outer suburbs is showing early success in steering young people away from crime. It aims to reduce the significant overrepresentation of young people from Pacifica and African backgrounds by pairing at-risk teenagers with mentors who've overcome gang affiliation and youth offending of their own. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Luetha Quay's early years were marked by trauma and violence.
You're going through all these things, and then there's lack of social acceptance, and then there's the media portrayal that's really looking at you more as a statistic than a human. You end up making the bad decisions.
He turned to crime, but credits his faith with eventually helping him leave it behind.
I didn't really see myself as more than just a criminal, but the Bible does say that God qualifies the unqualified, and I think I'm a true testament of that.
At 25, Luetha Quay now mentors young offenders to help them also turn away from crime.
We share the same experiences, right? And we're able to leverage off that, you know? And we're able to guide them rather than, you know, imposing change on them. I think our goal is to prompt change from within.
Participants are referred to the Centre for Multicultural Youth's Lived Experience Mentoring Project by the government agency overseeing young offenders. Mentors with similar backgrounds are paired with African Australian and Pacifica youth, who are significantly overrepresented in the crime data. Team leader Jean Bell says the first 12 months show the project is changing behaviours.
It's about giving them the opportunity to develop that self-belief, see themselves in a different light. And if you spend the time doing that, you will eventually see a shift in their identity. They will naturally pull away from the offending lifestyle.
Hakiaha Pokoro also grew up without much money or stable housing. He was exposed to violence, substance abuse and gangs.
What really drives me to be a lived experience mentor is just trying to give the support to the boys that are coming through the system, that type of support that I wish I had, and just to show them that we can still turn our lives around.
Victoria's crime rate rose 16% in the 12 months to June, and high-profile youth crime like the alleged stabbing murders of two children last month is fueling the heated political debate on how to address the issue. The Victorian government has banned machetes and strengthened bail laws, but experts say behaviour change programs like the Mentor Project are the most effective way to reduce crime. Dr. Samara McFedrin is a principal research fellow at Griffith University.
It's things that don't necessarily on the surface look as if they are crime or violence prevention activities. Things like education, employment, good social supports, good social services.
That's backed by criminologist Dr. Joel McGregor from Swinburne University.
While the community might feel safe by these immediate interventions, such as changes in bail laws or tougher policing of young people, we're unlikely to see longer-term effects.
Criminologist Dr. Joel McGregor, ending that report by Bridget Fitzgerald. There are 5.5 million Australians living with disability, and many have experienced some form of discrimination. Australia has a Disability Discrimination Act, but advocates say the decades-old legislation is out of date and not as effective as it should be. The federal government is currently reviewing the Act. It was a key recommendation of the Disability Royal Commission. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
When Sarah was starting her master's 3 years ago, she was feeling really excited. The Victorian resident lives with physical and psychosocial disabilities, so she was eligible for support through her university's student services department.
I requested flexible course arrangements, flexible attendance, and hybrid studies.
But things took a turn when she was told the assistance she asked for would not be granted. Disappointed with the outcome, Sarah tried to continue with her studies without those adjustments.
I didn't think that I was asking for much. And it was backed up by my doctors that I required these adjustments.
Sarah's disabilities means some days she physically can't get out of bed. She experiences fatigue and periods of burnout. In the end, Sarah says her degree became unmanageable and she decided to defer her studies. She sought advice from an independent advocate who told her it was a clear case of discrimination. Treating people with disability unfairly is outlawed, but the current legislation relies on people like Sarah making a complaint. That process can be difficult to navigate.
Even just making an internal complaint was so tiring, and it was like a huge administrative burden.
In its final report, the Disability Royal Commission made several recommendations about how disability discrimination laws should be changed, including by shifting the burden of proof so the alleged discriminator must show their treatment of an aggrieved person was not on the grounds of their disability. The federal government has accepted the recommendations in principle and is currently reviewing the Disability Discrimination Act, which was introduced in 1992. The president of the Australian Human Rights Commission, Hugh de Kretser, says it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity.
Our disability discrimination laws at the national level are out of date and not as effective as they should be.
The commission receives almost 3,000 discrimination complaints each year. Disability forms about half of those complaints, particularly in areas like the provision of goods and services, education and employment. Why do you think that is so high compared to the other areas of discrimination?
It speaks to partly the prevalence of disability discrimination in our community. It also speaks to the good advocacy by people with disability to take action.
Hugh de Kretser says one of the Commission's key suggestions is that the Disability Discrimination Act place a positive duty on organisations to take preventative action to eliminate disability discrimination, not just react to it.
Ultimately, we want to make our society better for people with disabilities so that they can participate in it as equals.
Today is the final day to make a submission to the review.
Naz Campanella. Would you sign up for the job of tempting snakes to lunge at artificial prey in the name of research? That's exactly what Australian researchers did in France to better understand how venomous snake bite, including the Australian rough-scaled death adder. Joanna Crothers reports.
On the outskirts of Paris, 36 species of snake were put in a glass experimental arena, complete with high-speed cameras, and tempted with a cylinder made of medical gel designed to mimic prey.
The very fastest vipers, they moved at about 4.5 metres per second.
That's zoologist and professor of biology, Alistair Evans. He helped work on this snake research project from Monash University, which was carried out at a specialist venom production facility in France. Each snake was put in the glass area one at a time, and an experimenter used a pole fitted with the artificial prey to entice bites.
It's quite a phenomenal sight because they open their jaws very rapidly. The vipers actually have fangs that fold back into their mouth. So when they open their mouth, they also fold these fangs forward. Some of them were even dripping venom as they're going towards the prey.
Researchers looked at three main families of venomous snakes: vipers, the elapids, and colubrids. In Australia, the most common group is the elapids, which include the eastern brown snake, the red-bellied black snake, and the inland taipan. Professor Alistair Evans says elapids sneak up before striking.
They have fixed fangs at the front of their jaw, and when we watched them striking their prey, what they often did was bite initially and then repeatedly bite or pump their jaws.
The study found colubrids sweep their jaws from side to side to make a large wound and deliver maximum venom. Snake researcher Timothy Jackson says the research is an important contribution to the intuition scientists have about the biology of venomous snakes.
Look, it's really cool having all of that quantitative analysis to confirm or nuance those intuitions is really important.
He's from the Australian Venom Research Unit at the University of Melbourne. He says snake research in Australia isn't integrated well and that it's hard to do studies like this here because we lack the venom labs and resources.
And they're so busy producing venom for commercial contracts that getting this kind of work done there would be kind of impossible without bringing in more staff.
Professor Alistair Evans says venomous snakes are so diverse and expanding research is crucial to helping conserve them.
Not only by looking at all these individual species, can we get an idea of the differences in their feeding type and their speed?
The study is the first to compare strike performance across 36 species and is published in the Journal of Experimental Biology.
That story from Joanna Crothers and Jacinta Bowler. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Ahead of his election, Donald Trump promised to deport millions of undocumented migrants. At one point, he even predicted 20 million people would be removed from America. So where is he up to with his pledge? Today, Caitlin Dickerson from The Atlantic magazine on how the president's campaign is about to ramp up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.